Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello again, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this Lori's Laughing Tuesday, and here's why. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Miles Konfleson, dear friend of the show, is standing by. We have a Miles scoop, which we will unveil in a little bit. A big scoop. Well, it's a big scoop in my world, okay? But I don't think anybody, I have no idea how many other people are going to care about this scoop. But anyway, before we bring Miles on, I just have to say, folks, I've been hearing about this for quite a while from my friends of the Lori Lightfoot persuasion. And these are people who love Lori still, okay? They love Lori to this day. They think she got a bad deal. She was underestimated as mayor, et cetera, and so forth. So two things have them chortling, literally chortling. I've very rarely heard someone chortle. Chortle is a derisive laugh where you're mocking somebody with laugh. You're not like really laughing at the humor. You're just mocking someone. So a chortle. Brandon Johnson and his Bears stadium deal, which my beloved lefties would be ripping from one end of the earth to the other if it had been introduced by Lori Lightfoot or Rahm Emanuel or Mayor Daley. But a lot of my lefty friends, my dear lefty friends, don't know what to do because they have an allegiance, a loyalty to Brandon, but they're like, what are you doing? Giving rich guys money. Our schools are broke. Anyway, so my Lori Lightfoot friends are chortling over that. But then this breaking news has them chortling even more. And this one kind of has me chortling as well. I don't know if I didn't talk about this with Miles before on the air. I don't even know if he followed this. Kind of not gotten a lot of attention, except for listeners of the Ben Jarofsky show. At least four of them have sent me the link. Have you seen this? And this they're asking me if I've seen is the article that was in Politico talking about David Pecker's testimony under cross-examination in the hush money trial of Donald Trump in New York City. David Pecker, of course, is the publisher of the National Enquirer, an ally of Trump, an acolyte of Trump. He's one of these guys who just revered Trump. Michael Cohen was that way as well. Trump produces particularly men who just look idolize him and love him and want to be him. It's really kind of a weird cultish thing. So when Pecker was the in charge of the National Enquirer, he was doing this thing called catch and kill. And that's where you take a story about a prominent person, a scandalous story about them, where somebody's saying, let's say, Billy Bob had an affair with me. I'll tell all. And you go, okay, I will pay you $20,000 to tell all. Tell me the whole story of your affair with Billy Bob. And then you will sign this non-disclosure agreement. You can't take that story anywhere else. And then instead of publishing the story, they kill it. So it's a way of silencing an embarrassing person by paying them off. It's essentially a payoff. And Donald Trump did that. That's part of the trial with Pecker to silence revelation of Stormy Daniels. I think it was Karen McDougal, the Playboy. Playboy centerfold that Trump had an affair with. So while under cross-examination in this trial, Pecker revealed that he had done this with another prominent person, and that prominent person was Rahm Emanuel, former mayor of the city of Chicago. How about that, all you little Rahm heads out there in Lincoln Park? You love Rahm so much. That's your guy, huh? Turns out that allegedly Rahm was having an affair, and his brother went to Pecker and essentially sold Pecker, got Pecker to buy the story, and they killed it. How about that, ladies and gentlemen? Anyway, so here's the part that just has me smiling. So Politico breaks the story. Now, you know how the Chicago media is, Miles. You know how if there's anything related to Chicago, they want to highlight it. because basically the Chicago media, the Chicagoans thinks you're a bunch of morons. It's like you only care about something if there's a Chicago angle. Like when the Queen died, you only cared about when the Queen died because she stayed here for less than a day in 1959 before Miles was born, long before Miles was born. Queen stayed in Chicago for one day. The Sun-Times, huge headline. She was one of us. She didn't love you, Chicago. She was here for less than a day and got out as soon as she came here and never came back. Sort of like Barack Obama in a way, okay? Anyway, so you will think, oh, my God, there's a Chicago angle to the Hush Money trial in New York. This is going to be huge news. Front page of my beloved Bright One. A really clever headline about Rahm's brother getting the National Enquirer publisher to bury a story about Rahm's steamy sex life. Oh, the Tribune's going to go. Everybody's going to, Cranes is going to weigh in with it. Nothing, ladies and gentlemen. The Bright One, they had this little dinky story. They didn't even put a byline on it, but the Sun-Times staff. Everybody's still afraid of Rahm, I guess, at the Sun-Times. We're afraid he'll get mad at us. He won't call us. And here's my favorite part. In the story, Miles, they go, Rahm Emanuel cannot be found for comment. I'm like, what? You don't have any trouble finding him for comment when it's something that makes him look good. Then he doesn't stop talking to you. And you're like running stories. Rahm weighs in on, I don't know, Rahm was always weighed the presidential election. Like he's this great, sagacious politico with wise, deep thoughts. Rahm weighs in on the ceasefire. Remember that? He jumped in on the ceasefire. Rahm weighs in on the Middle East. Like he's thought about this a long time. It's great. Whenever Rahm wants to talk about something that thinks it's going to make him look good, the Sun-Times doesn't have any trouble finding him. You know, they didn't find trouble. Nope, but here's the scandal. They can't find him. Where is he? Hello, Rahm. I can't find you. So embarrassed me. Just guys to show you guys how the mainstream media treats different mayors differently. They gave Rahm and Daley the kid glove treatment compared to what they give Lori Lightfoot and Brandon Johnson. And we all know it. So stop fooling yourself, mainstream media. You know you did it. You probably get more pressure from people on top to go easy on Rahm. But that one had me laughing. Couldn't find him for comment. Where is he? All right, enough on that. Miles Konflassen, welcome back. Editor, writer extraordinaire from In These Times. Chicago native, Whitney Young graduate, and diehard Bulls fan. Welcome back, young man.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Any thoughts? We didn't talk about this in our pre-show prep, which we spent way too much time talking about the Bulls. Any thoughts on the media's attitude toward different mayors? You're an obsessive reader of the media, of the local media. You read all the papers, you read all the like Block Club, et cetera, and so forth. Any thoughts? Do you think I'm being unfair to the media? Feel free to say so, that there's a double standard, the way they treat Rahm and the way they treat Brandon and Lori Lightfoot.
Well, there's no doubt it's a far more adversarial relationship. And it has been, yeah, I agree. It was so under Mayor Lightfoot as well. And certainly currently the relationship between the mayor's office and the press is pretty icy. I will say, you know, the real scandal under Rahm Emanuel's watch was his cover up of a murder of a, you know, black teenager by the Chicago Police Department. It did eventually get some coverage, became a massive scandal. But it was suppressed, right, by his office and certainly by the media. I'd say also a big scandal under the mayorship of Rahm Emanuel was his privatization of, you know, city assets and resources and the introduction of, you know, all these austerity policies, starving communities of resources. And even before he got elected, you know, the real scandal was that he didn't live in Chicago. He didn't meet residency requirements, and that just all got papered over, right? So, I mean, the sex scandal might have been, you know, an issue for him in, you know, in the campaigns he ran, but I think there was plenty of scandals out there that just they didn't get treated the same way as they probably would, you know, under a different mayor. And it has to do with political clout and capital. And I think, of course, Rahm Emanuel's relationship to the aforementioned Barack Obama, that who's like, you know, untouchable in Chicago media and politics seemingly. Yeah. And so I think that, you know, spared him the type of scrutiny that you would see under mayors without as much political connection to, you know, the power elite people, you know, and that includes both Lightfoot, but certainly Brandon Johnson as well.
Yeah, and just so everybody understands, Rahm's alleged sex scandal, the one that David Pecker says that Rahm's brother paid him to bury, that happened before his mayoral term. So whatever it was, wherever it occurred, whoever his partner was in that, it happened before he was mayor. So I can't, as critical as I may be of the mainstream media, I can't blame them for not writing about something they didn't know. But you know it now. Anyway, where is he? Hold on, Miles. I'm going to look for Rahm. I am, by the way, doing this show from Hollywood. Not really Hollywood, but I'm in L.A., so I call it Hollywood. I'm very, very Hollywood. But if you could see this room I'm in, Miles, I'm with the dogs. So I just looked in the dog's cage, and Rahm's not there. Okay, so sometimes I did my best. I probably looked harder for Rahm just now than you did sometimes. I can't find him anywhere. All right, Miles. What are we going to discuss? Three main things I want to talk to you about today, and I'll list them now so I don't forget them. One, Bear Stadium, local level. Two, the movement at universities protesting Israel's war against Gaza. And the impact that's having on national politics. And then the Volkswagen vote. And a lot of our listeners, they turn to you for union coverage. So we'll start with that first, and then we'll go to the other issues. Historic vote, I think it was last week. I've lost track of time, Miles, at a Volkswagen plant in Tennessee. I want to say 73%, I'm doing this off the top of my head again, of the workers at the plant voted for union, which is an astounding high number given the circumstances. Okay, all right, it's not as high as the 100% that voted at the Reader when we unionized, but many different circumstances between a lefty newspaper in Chicago and a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Why don't you take it away, Miles?
Well, also, there were 4,000 workers at this plant in Chattanooga. It's a few more than the Reader has on staff, I believe. Yes. So you can imagine there might be a little bit more dissent. But, you know, when you look at that, you know, layout of the vote total, that is astounding. And when you consider that this is the third try in the past 10 years, it happened 10 years ago and then 5 or 6 years ago was a second attempt to organize this same facility. And both of those efforts went down in defeat. And this is overwhelming. As you said, nearly one in every four or three out of four workers voted to unionize. And this is, you know, the I think the only non-union auto shop that the Volkswagen has will now be unionized. And it's no coincidence that it was in Tennessee, which is, you know, a right to work state, historically anti-union state. This is where companies go to build facilities to avoid having to engage in collective bargaining with a union, and so that they can, you know, pay lower wages, so that they can fire workers whenever they want, where they don't have to, you know, be covered by the same type of worker protections and safety ordinances that are often in union contracts. It's basically a way to offshore jobs, but within the United States. This is how companies view the anti-union South, as a place that they can threaten to move their facilities or even actually move their facilities in the cases of a number of these big companies, especially auto companies, and then, you know, take the jobs away from the North, build them in the South, and evade labor laws, not to mention, you know, environmental protections that might be in place in other places, you know, wage laws they might have to comply with that exist in northern states where, you know, there's higher minimum wage laws, for example. So that's how these companies view the South, is just a way to evade unions and worker protections and workers' rights. And now we're starting to see that dynamic start to change, because this new leadership of the United Auto Workers, who last fall, as we know, went on strike against the big three automakers and won, really historic contracts. They have then transferred the energy behind those victories into a massive new organizing campaign, the most ambitious that we really have seen in the modern American labor movement. They're planning to organize 150,000 new auto workers, or, you know, workers that would join the UAW, which would essentially double the union's membership. They've already gotten over 10,000 workers to sign on cards, you know, and this is just since last November. And they've already won this union election in Chattanooga, which is a real beachhead in terms of organizing the South later this month. In I think May 17th, so the coming month, we're going to see a vote at a Mercedes plant in Alabama. And that would be another huge victory, right? Because Mercedes, I think this is one of only two Mercedes plants that's non-union. This is where they're like building Maybachs. They're building these giant, you know, luxury automobiles. And yet the workers are getting treated, you know, in horrible ways. And they have been. This isn't the first time there's been a union effort there, but it's the first time it seems like it really might be successful, partially because it's being worker-led and because there's this new dynamic spirit to Sean Fain and the leadership of the UAW that's taking a very adversarial approach and saying, you know, we're not going to try to make nice with management or the boss and, like, come up with some equally hospitable kind of deal. We're going to actually go for the gold and try to, you know, extract as much as we can out of this company to benefit workers. And if we see them vote, I think that'll be a clear sign, you know, victory begets victory. Like, more and more workers are going to see that at places like, you know, Hyundai, Toyota, Honda, these other oftentimes foreign owned factories that have non-union plants here. They're going to start moving to organize. And that could really change this whole dynamic and make it, you know, much more common for workers to expect to have a union. And we should just say, like, it's not just this is happening in isolation. They're throwing everything they can to stop this stuff, right? There is massive anti-union interference going on politically. You know, you see in Alabama, Governor Ivey, this hardcore right-wing governor, is saying, you know, this is going to destroy the economy of Alabama if they go union. It's all this crazy hand-wringing. One of the things you saw in Tennessee is that they were trying to, like, you know, play on Joe Biden's support for the UAW to get workers to vote against it. They put up these big billboards around the factory with Biden's face saying, you know, is this who you want to be on the side with, kind of thing, to try to scare workers off. And try to, like, use the fact that these are largely, you know, often Republican states, a lot of Republican members, to get workers to vote against the union. And it's not working. Like, they're trying everything and the workers still are charging forward. And I think that's a real sign of how, you know, worker power spreads. When people realize the power of collective action and coming together, and especially now that they're seeing how many benefits, you know, in wage gains, like 25% wage gains the workers got at Ford and Stellantis and General Motors. Like, they see that and they're like, I want that. Like, why am I getting paid less just because I live in a different state? And so this could start to really revive the spirit of American labor. And I think especially ahead of May Day here, where, you know, in Chicago is the birthplace of the International Workers' Day and the fight for an 8-hour workday, a shorter work week. It's especially notable that we're seeing an upsurge in labor organizing and activism across the country, not just happening in, like, you know, metropolitan cities, but happening everywhere from, yeah, Chattanooga to Alabama.
Wow. Let's just pause and reflect on the utter insanity of politics in America today before we get back to the general theme. Using Joe Biden's face to get to convince auto workers to vote against their economic self-interest. It's so bizarre and twisted. So essentially what the manufacturers, the auto manufacturers realize is that the workers in their plants despise Joe Biden and love Donnie Trump. And so they can just put, and even though Joe Biden supports their unionizing movement and Donald Trump and the Republican Party opposes it. So this is really twisted, weird world we live in, Miles, and it's very hard to make sense of it. Normally, you'd expect people to vote in their economic self-interest when it comes to a presidential election. In this case, they are thinking their strategy is these people hate Joe Biden so much that they will vote against their economic self-interest just because they realize Joe Biden supports them getting more money. The words right now, I don't really know what to say this is other than insanity. Your thoughts?
Well, the attempt was built on this false premise, though, right? That would work, that workers would see, you know, Biden standing with the union and be like, well, screw the union then. They might still oppose Biden, you know, and not vote for him. Granted, these are, you know, heavily red states, but that's not enough to stop worker power, because they realize this isn't Joe Biden coming in and trying to unionize them. It's their coworkers unionizing them, or, you know, them unionizing together. Like, they are the union. And I think that's the real difference in this and these campaigns we're seeing versus previous ones, where it's been very top down and, you know, unions send in organizers and they're very like managed and, you know, we can only do this in private and it's kind of hush hush. That's a very different approach than what's being taken now, which is very overtly and in public trying to organize right on the shop floor. And I think because of that, workers are seeing this isn't some outside force, whether it's a, you know, Democratic politician or whether it's like a, you know, establishment union that's coming in. It's the workers themselves that are like leading these efforts. And that's very similar to what we're seeing at Starbucks and Trader Joe's and Amazon and these other big chains and retail industries, where we're seeing independent unions form, or at least they're affiliating with unions, but they're running it as a worker-led effort. And that has seemingly been more successful, because I think that shows that it's a very like homegrown effort. It's not some exterior, you know, entity that's coming in and trying to control workers. But you're right to point out the kind of absurd political dynamics at play, because these, you know, Jay Ivey is trying to crush workers' rights. And meanwhile, he's saying, you know, oh, we can't have a union. It's going to destroy our economy. Well, yeah, it's going to destroy the type of economy that continues to, you know, provide meager wages for workers while enriching, you know, corporate profiteers at all costs. Like, that's what is happening in terms of Alabama's economy and has for a long time, because it continues to elect, you know, right-wing politicians that are in favor of this economic status quo, and workers are tired of it and sick of it. And so I think that the more we're starting to see these positions kind of radicalize against one another, like, you know, right versus left, or, you know, Republican, Democrat, like kind of commingling with this union effort, the result is workers becoming more clear of their own power and not necessarily being beholden to any, you know, political party necessarily. Ultimately, though, as we know, you know, when you look at union membership, it tends to, being in a union tends to make, you know, its membership more liberal, more progressive, because, you know, the process of unionizing and working together is itself kind of a liberalizing process. And, you know, as a result of it, you want to support the type of politicians that are supporting those efforts. And by and large, those are Democrats, not all Democrats. There's plenty of corporate centrist Democrats that have been, you know, on the wrong side of these efforts. But certainly the more progressive ones have been the biggest champions of organized labor. And that's why, you know, the ultimate impact, I think, of much of this is going to be a political move to the left and in a much more progressive direction. If we start to see the ranks of union membership and union density grow, that's only going to benefit the Democrats, really, and those on the political left. And I think that that's, you know, part of the reason for making the type of investments now in labor organizing as a tool, as a political tool, to achieve greater social goods, not just in the workplace, but across other realms of society, whether it's like education or housing or healthcare, when you start to see people, you know, as I said, like realize collective action as a way to increase their well-being and their economic self-interest, as you said, that opens people up to further possibilities of how to reorganize society to benefit the working class, even if that means, you know, especially if it means taking on the corporate interests that like tend to dominate our political life.
Yeah. And so just the basic math that Miles pointed out earlier, there's approximately even split roughly, I'm just speaking in rough terms, between non-union and unionized auto workers, roughly 300,000 auto workers in this country, 150,000 unionized, 150,000 non-unionized. So that's kind of the ballpark figures, as I understand it, Miles. So if we flip that, or if the unions flip that, it will, in my humble opinion, have a significant impact just on general attitudes. I'm not saying all struggles will then end, but I think it will have just a larger impact across the board if Sean Fain makes inroads. Talk a little bit about him. He just wrote an essay for In These Times. You alluded to it before in the pre-show, and I haven't had an opportunity to read it because it just literally broke. But why don't you just talk about the strategies and the tactics he's employed to get this far? He's the head of the United Auto Workers. Go ahead.
And he's the first democratically elected head. He was elected late last year, the first like membership vote. They previously had some Byzantine process for electing leadership. But yeah, he's a democratically elected leader, and he has taken on a much more confrontational approach with management. And people probably saw last fall him, you know, tossing the contract proposals into the literal trash can, you know, on these Facebook Live events he would do with membership. And he was very open about the process of bargaining. Kind of reminds me of how, you know, CTU has done a bargaining process where they bring the whole big bargaining team out, you know, and do these press conferences and talk about like what, you know, happened each day. And now we're talking about, you know, ahead of the contract, I think it's up in June, right? The CTU contract, and they're talking about wanting to do bargaining out in the open. That's kind of how Sean Fain approached that process too, which is very different from previous leaders. And we should say, like, you know, United Auto Workers is the name of the union, and we're talking about like auto plants and auto facilities, but they represent workers across like a wide range of industries, especially academic workers. More and more, you know, graduate students and faculty at colleges and universities have joined up mm-hmm. with the United Auto Workers. So just because, you know, union has a certain name doesn't mean that's the only type of worker that that they represent. I'm in the News Guild, you know, as part of in These Times staff union, but the News Guild also covers all kinds of like nonprofit workers and political organizations and people like that. So you got to like, you know, the membership doesn't always necessarily directly reflect just the name. So, you know, Sean Fain is the head of this massive union, one of the most powerful, influential unions in the country now. And he's using that perch to project a openly, like, you know, working class led, energized militant labor movement as a way to upend the current condition that workers face, where bosses hold tyrannical power over our lives in the workplace, and make every decision, and workers are at their, you know, beck and call at any case. You know, in order to flip that, then we need to build worker power and build the actual organizations of worker power, which right now are in unions. And the piece that he wrote for In These Times, it's up at inthesetimes.com right now, is about how the UAW has set the strike, the end of the contract. So they, you know, negotiated all these three contracts at Ford, GM, and Stellantis last year. They set them to end all on the same date, and that's April 28th, 2028, so 4 years from now. Mm. The reason they did that is to have leverage so that the next day is May Day, May 1st, International Workers' Day, a holiday celebrated across the globe, conspicuously not in the United States. You know, we don't really celebrate that besides, you know, some of us left-wing organizers and our allies, you know, go out and rally and march and honor the fact that this is, you know, especially Chicago is the site of the Haymarket Martyrs that were executed by the state in order, you know, for the crime of organizing working people. That's a holiday celebrated globally. And what Sean Fain is proposing is for unions and industries across the board to all have that same end date on their contracts so that there could be one big, potentially general strike on May 1st, 2028, which could, you know, bring these industries to heel, so to speak, and cause and force them to really negotiate with workers. And part of this is built off this idea of solidarity, of unions members standing with one another in their fights. And for example, and an example that Sean Fain points to is that during the strike against the automakers, they met with the Teamsters, which is a completely different union, different industry. They have nothing to do with the negotiations going on between UAW and the automakers. But the Teamsters said, look, we're going to stand in solidarity with you and refuse to have our truck drivers deliver parts to those auto facilities as long as you're striking them, standing, you know, in solidarity with them. And as a result of that, that helped to shut down production at the facilities, which then increased the pressure on the companies and the leverage of the auto workers. So, you know, when unions, multiple unions stand together, they can really force the hand of management at huge companies that, you know, control huge cross sections of the economy. So if there was, you know, if this effort is successful and a number of industries, all, you know, companies and unions all go out on strike on May 1st, or at least threaten to strike, that could have a really major impact on the power that workers collectively hold in this country and could result in some really true benefits to working people. And the last thing I'll say on that is that one of the big pushes that Sean Fain has introduced and that more and more people are talking about now is the idea of a 32-hour work week. You know, back in the late 1800s, the fight was over a 40-hour work week. Well, we're, you know, well over a century later and still working under this regime of 8-hour workday, 5 days a week, while our productivity has gone up. You know, we see automation, and yet we haven't been fighting for less time on the job. And that's long been the goal of labor unions and worker organizations, to say, hey, we should be working less. We should have more free time in our lives to be able to, you know, do what we will. And so that was one of the proposals that Sean Fain put forward and his union put forward in their contract proposals with the UAW, with the Big Three, was for a 32-hour work week. Now we see national legislation has been introduced in Congress, sponsored by Bernie Sanders and other progressives, to actually put in place a 32-hour work week in the U.S. That, you know, if we continue to see movement, and we are starting to see certain businesses try out a 32-hour work week, and they are all reporting massive success in it. And so if we see more and more companies, you know, move towards that, more and more unions call for it, that could be a big demand on that date of May 1st, 2028, is to win a 32-hour work week, which would have a massive impact on working people's lives if they are able to work less and have more time to be with their families, more time to, you know, go to the beach, like, you know, engage in leisure, not have to spend their lives toiling to make profits for some far off boss. You know, as Marx said, labor creates all wealth. We are the engines that make our society run. And yet so often we are divorced from the benefits of that labor. You know, the fortunes are held in far off, you know, destinations on yachts somewhere, when we are, you know, the ones pouring our sweat into making the economy run. So if workers can benefit by having more free time over their lives, I think that would radically change kind of the conditions of our lives here in the United States.
I'm smiling at you quoting Marx, and I was just thinking, over the last week, my show has become pretty popular with the right-wing critics of Brandon Johnson, because I've been bashing his stadium deal. Right-wing critics of Brandon Johnson, feel free to quote that one, okay? Put that one out. Karl Marx quoted on the Ben Jarofsky show and in a positive light. Labor creates all wealthy. I don't think they're going to be quoting that part of the show anytime soon. All right, let's, before we come back to Chicago, close with your thoughts on the Bears and my beloved Bulls, and we reveal the big secret on today's show. Talk a little bit about the ongoing campus protests. They started, I think, in New York, and now pretty much every state in the country, but a lot of states in the country, college campuses are having protests on behalf of ending the slaughter in Gaza, at the very least. Miles, your thoughts on how this impacts just the world in general, things I thought I would never see, but I am seeing right now. Go ahead.
Well, I never thought we'd see such an outpouring of support for the dignity of Palestinian life, especially across, you know, universities in the United States, where that kind of speech has been silenced for so long. You know, we're and it's connected to Chicago as well. You know, we just saw today an encampment go up at DePaul University. We previously have seen one at Northwestern, at University of Chicago as well. And the backdrop of this, we should just be very clear, like, we are still in the midst of a horrific assault on Gaza being carried out by the Israeli military. Over 34,000 Palestinians have been killed, far more injured, the majority of them are women and children, and the assault continues. You know, we just saw another bombing in Rafah today that killed a number of women and children. I mean, this is going on with the full backing of the U.S. We just saw mass graves uncovered. In many cases, you know, these people were had hands tied behind their backs, in some cases buried alive. This is the type of really odious and, like, horrific evidence we would call, you know, not just a humanitarian disaster, but criminal. You know, these are what widely are seen as war crimes and genocidal behavior that is happening with the full-fledged support of the U.S. The Congress just passed another $26 billion in aid to send to Israel, which includes offensive weaponry. And this is exactly why these protests are so critical, not just on the encampments, but across the protests in the streets across the U.S., is because we have a special relationship with Israel. This is not some, you know, conflict going on in a far-off land we have no control over. These are all happening with the full support of our government. And because of that, we have a say in how those decisions are made. If this is meant to be a democracy, then democratic activity must include voicing dissent against the decisions of our government when the result of them is this absolutely devastating loss of human life going on in Gaza. And so what these encampments are about is saying, you know, universities and colleges are complicit as well, both by having financial ties to Israel as well as having investments in companies that are abetting and benefiting from the ongoing genocide. And so the demands, by and large, are for these universities to disclose their investments and to divest from these companies and end these financial dealings. And that's why when you see this coverage in the media, they often don't talk about that. They'll talk about, you know, what has been brought up as, like, you know, anti-Semitic behavior going on and focusing on the safety of certain students versus the actual underlying issue, which is that these students are speaking out against the unsafety of anybody living in the entire enclave of Gaza as it continues to be under assault by Israel with bombs that are made by U.S. companies. You know, I say that, you know, when we pass these kinds of spending bills to give aid to countries like Israel in this case, what we're doing is effectively subsidizing the U.S. defense contractors because they are the ones that are going to be making the bombs that are going to be sent. This is, you know, the U.S. really, we have two big exports. We export our culture, obviously, you know, music, fashion, television, Hollywood, you know, that is spread across the globe. And the other big export is bombs. You go to, you know, any kind of military conflict across the world, and you're going to see connections to U.S. Defense contractors, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing. And these are the companies that are then benefiting from passing these aid bills. Well, we can have a voice and say, no, we're not going to be putting taxpayer money into this. The connections are so clear. You know, you look across, it's not just universities and Israel. It's, you know, the Caterpillar is the based in Peoria, Illinois, you know, where a lot of these bulldozers are made. These are the same Caterpillar bulldozers being used to crush refugee camps in Gaza that we saw in, you know, Idaho, the people picking chickpeas. Those are could be sent to, you know, Sabra hummus, which is all these, you know, factories on illegal encampments in the West Bank. The U.S. has a particular role in this conflict, and I think a special responsibility is on those who believe in peace and an end to violence to speak out and demand an end to this. And that's what we're seeing in these encampments. And we've been sold this, you know, narrative that Gen Z is like lazy and sensitive, and they're, you know, they need to be coddled, and they need safe spaces, and all of this kind of BS that is, you know, permeates the media. And look at what is going on. These are young people who are risking their like academic careers, in some cases their safety. They're facing down militarized police that are, you know, storming these encampments, and they're refusing to leave. They're locking arms and saying, no, this is our call right now. You know, we are willing to put a lot of our, you know, our future on the line in order to send this message and say we are, you know, taking a stand that is, you know, pro-life in terms of pro-Palestinian life, that is pro, you know, peace across the board. And if that means being met with political repression or state repression, so be it. But what we're seeing is that the protests are spreading. This type of repression is not working. And in fact, it's causing more people to join in this effort. And I think it's just like a lesson unlearned by the political establishment again and again, is that you cannot use the police to crush dissent. Dissent does not go away. It just spreads and festers and comes out in other ways, you know, that are, you know, yet to be seen. But I will say this is raising a whole generation of young people, especially the people at, you know, elite universities. They're going to be in powerful positions in the future to understand that, you know, the cause of Palestinian freedom and liberation is a cause worth fighting for. And that is not what we have previously seen, you know, in earlier generations of America so clearly on college campuses. And I think that's going to have a dramatic effect down the road as we see these protests continue to expand.
Wow, that was a great riff. I think a lot about a lot of different things you said. So, of course, I'm going to start with this one. Coddled Gen Z and millennials, throw them in the book. I make fun of millennials and Gen Zs just much as the next baby boomer, but Miles, it's like, that's just good natured joking. Gen Zs and millennials compared to baby boomers, your generation is so far ahead of the game. Baby boomers, Miles, way before your time, you're a millennial. Baby boomers, they protested the Vietnam War when they thought they were going to go to Vietnam. And they linked it to all other causes, you know, civil rights, women's rights, etc. And then as soon as the draft was done and they weren't under threat, boom, they voted for Reagan. And they voted for Trump. And they're pretty much, in many ways, a worthless generation, baby boomers, other than, you know, a few great athletes that I love, I mean, music people. But so, yeah, I mean, this is, I don't see a self-interest at play on the part of Gen X, the Zs or the millennials who are protesting. I don't. But baby boomers, they didn't want to go to Vietnam. That was their self-interest. So this is something I've never seen, I got to tell you, Miles, this level. And it's far greater than, just think about this. This is your wheelhouse. You do know this. When Bush invaded, just think about this. When Bush invaded Iraq, had nothing to do with 9/11, Miles. No. There was a level of opposition in this country from the left. I know, because many of them related to me. But nothing like this, Miles. There were kids, you know what? There were kids who walked out of school in Chicago. I think you may have, you still been at Whitney Young, or you may have graduated, but right after you graduated, they walked out. A lot of these schools punished them. You know what I'm saying? For walking out. That was where the Daley administration was back in 2003, pretty much joined with Bush in supporting the war. And there was still, this country was having a reaction, not unlike the one in Israel. Like, we need vengeance. We want to kill people to avenge 9/11. That's such a huge nationalistic impulse in a country, Miles. You know this. So when the young people at the university stand up, they're like, I can't recall seeing anything like this. Maybe you can help me here, Miles, and say, no, Ben, there was a historical precedent set, but I can't think of one right now. When they don't have, it's not like their skin is in the game. Do you understand what I'm saying, Miles? It's not like their neck is on the line. They're not about to have to go to Vietnam. They're not going to get drafted. So, and they're having a, you and I have talked in the past about the impact they're having on national politics, how Joe Biden's suddenly, I got to figure something out here because I'm going to lose this election to the fascist. And the Dems are like, what are we going to do? I think you're right on. It's unprecedented. Well,
I think the skin they have in the game is a sense of morality, and that we need to, you know, there are certainly plenty of people of, you know, Arab Muslim descent, of Palestinian descent, Lebanese descent, you know, people that have direct connections to what is happening and the fact that there's a genocide going on. But it's also that we are living in a time when these images are being fed to us, you know, nonstop. You know, you go on any social media app, you know, you might not be covered in the mainstream media, but people are seeing in front of their eyes a tragedy unfolding. And so much loss of innocent life at a degree and scale and of you know, the hands of, you know, true horror that you can't look away from. And I think that is, you know, causing this upsurge of involvement and support, because people don't want to let this go by, you know, or sweep it under the rug. And I was in high school at Whitney Young in 2003 and did walk out against the war. And there was, you know, of course, nationwide protests, historic protests in 2003 as tanks rolled in. But there was also jingoism at the time. There was an immense sense of patriotism being led by the Bush administration and allies across the government. And that was also a time of silencing of dissent. You know, you couldn't hear the type of voices that you are able to access now speaking out. And that was by design. And I think the scale of it has reached a level at this point, you know, and this war has been going on for nearly 6 months. Wouldn't even call it a war. It's really just an assault at this stage. And as I said, you have that's some form of retribution. I mean, I'm not like, you know, I don't have inside information, but you can just see what is reported, which is that there is, you know, a deal to release hostages. And what Hamas is asking for, at least the negotiators, is to end this war. And that is what a ceasefire is. You know, it should be the end of the war. And yet that is considered untenable for Netanyahu, apparently, who wants to be able to continue to bomb and assault Gaza at all costs. And I think it's because he considers his political life on the line. Well, the lives that are actually on the line are being lost in the face of this. Well, and that is, it's the reason that there is so much, you know, built up anger from all sides, and that you're seeing so many Jewish students at the heart of these protests that are having Passover seders in the midst of calling for Palestinian freedom, because they see that the, you know, future of all people are linked together, that we, you know, exist in a you know, multiracial world and we're trying to build a democratic system out of that, we have to respect and value life wherever, you know, in all of its forms. And that's at the heart of much, you know, the Jewish religion. And so I think that's part of the reason you're seeing at the, the forefront of these protests, groups like If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace, saying that, you know, it's not in our name. We cannot be continuing to do this. And it's both not in our name, you know, for these communities as Jews, but also not in our name as Americans who are, as I said, complicit, whether we like it or not, because our tax dollars are going to pay for what is being carried out. And as I just to connect it to what we were talking about before, it's also why the UAW and other unions have joined this call for a ceasefire and been outspoken about it. That is a big change for the American labor movement to be outrightly anti-war, especially when it means criticizing a Democratic president who calls himself, you know, the most pro-labor president in history in Joe Biden, for them to also be pushing for a change in foreign policy is really notable, along with these with the encampments that are going up.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to avoid the temptation to go down a whole path about Netanyahu, Trump, and Hamas, and we'll move on to other things. But I do appreciate that Joy Ann Reid at MSNBC is picking up on this theme. I don't know if folks listen to her. We talk a lot about this on the Monroe Anderson comes on Wednesdays. We talk about this a lot because we've been talking about Netanyahu, Trump alliance since like November. Miles, and now I'm seeing, oh wow, Joy Ann Reid's now speaking about it. It's like spreading the noise. This is what's going on in the world. Fascism. And I will point out, in fairness, I will say this, in fairness to the lefties who took a stand in 2003, I didn't mean to besmirch you. I know there were people in the streets. And it's one thing to stand up to your government, the United States government, and the passions of nationalism. And it's something else to stand up to something that's across the seas and not directly affecting you. So I appreciate it. Took, you know, Miles, Trump, Daley didn't play. When the lefties, when the anti-war protesters took Lakeshore Drive, ooh, or mass arrests. The police wagons were waiting for them when they got off, and hundreds of them just got thrown in the police wagons and carted off to jail. And that was a crippling blow in many ways to mass protests. And Daley was sending a message through his police to George Bush, and Bush appreciated it. And never forget that when George Bush celebrated his 60th birthday, where did he go? He came to Chicago and had dinner with Daley, Richard M. Daley, ladies and gentlemen, at the time when the feds were knocking on the door of Daley on the various scandals. See, people forget this in Chicago, or they don't even know it. You know what I'm saying? But I remember it all. So I felt maybe I was a little too unfair to American protesters in 2003, you know, because they were there. And guys, Daley's police treated those protesters a lot harder than the college protesters getting treated. I'm just saying, Miles, they just threw them into the paddy wagon. Go to jail. Shut up. Anyway, get me off my soapbox. All right, Miles, get your thoughts on the Chicago Bears Stadium. I've totally trashed this as an idea. I'm like, Mayor Johnson, I love you, but what are you thinking? You know, spending all that money, handing over that money over to the Bears to build a stadium that they don't deserve, don't need. First of all, they could stay at Soldier Field, for goodness sakes. They still got like 8 years on their lease, I want to say, Miles, at least something like that, 10 years, I don't know. Or just go to Arlington Heights. Or, best of all, go build at the old steel mill at 87th Street in the lake. And you got to spend public dollars, clean up the land. It's the Del Marie Cobb Stadium. We'll call for Del Marie Cobb because she's been pushing that. Anything that helps her beloved South Side, she is for. Your general thoughts on all this, Miles, floor is yours.
I've long supported the idea of a South Side stadium. I think that's you're right, especially because so many of the investments that are on the, you know, public dollar side of this are regarding infrastructure, whether it's, you know, piping, repairs, roads, you know, because essentially the proposal now is to build like a new mini neighborhood. Right in, you know, I guess the South Loop. We've seen calls for that before, and, you know, the 78 is still pretty vacant, and, you know, the Lincoln Yards is certainly, you know, just, you know, sitting there idle. it's hard to have much confidence in, you know, these types of massive public-private partnerships when they require money on the public side. And, you know, I will say, it looks like a lot of these are, you know, investments in terms of like taking out debt, essentially, which would be a different way of financing than, like, say, raising taxes or something. And that would be the most kind of offensive way to the city of Chicago. But when we see, you know, things saying we're going to spur development and growth and build jobs, it's fair to question, like, how we're going to make sure that that isn't just money being recycled that would otherwise already be in the city, you know, around Soldier Field or wherever else you would build it, you know, unless we're really bringing in new money, you know, like that's what you see when like Taylor Swift performs here, right? Is like that there's all these people coming in to the city to see Taylor Swift. They're going, they're staying at the hotels, they're eating out of fancy restaurants. That's going to bring in a lot of, you know, tax revenue for the city. And there's conditions on some of these, you know, what has been proposed that all of that, you know, the benefit from, the sales to these concerts and stuff that would be held at this new Soldier Field or whatever they call it, New Bears Stadium, would just go to, you know, the financing of it. And if that's true, that's the, you know, it could cause the city to lose out on future financing. And that's, you know, I just think we've seen these proposals being put out before, and it generally has not been to the benefit of residents and taxpayers. There's also, as we have discussed, it's 8 games a year, you know, when it comes to the Bears. Like, what is this? How are we justifying this? And granted, you know, if you have a dome, you can change it, right? You can have basketball, you can have tennis, you can have, you know, concerts, you can, you know, throughout the year, you can have all kinds of different events in this space. But I do, like, there doesn't seem to be a plan for that yet, right? And so this, I would hope, is like an opening bid, right? Like negotiating wise. And I don't think, you know, it's true that the Johnson administration was there, like on the stage talking about it and has been defending this proposal. But it's like, really, this is like the Kevin Warren proposal. It's the Bears. This is what the Bears want. And so the city has to decide what they're going to get. You know, the Bears don't hold all the cards here. And certainly not Bears ownership or management. And so there is opportunities to, you know, change this or to reject it. You know, they wanted to do the Olympics here and that didn't happen, right? So like there are ways to kind of, you know, have organized opposition to these types of deals, or at least make them more beneficial to the public. And I think that's the most important part here, is like that whatever happens, it has to at least, even if it doesn't improve like urban life for a large segment of the population of Chicago, it at least shouldn't make it worse. And that's, I think, the real question to ask of like whether these things are worthy of supporting or not.
All right. And since you asked the question, I will answer it. Mayor Johnson, if you're listening, I know you're a huge fan of the Miles Konflossen appearances on the Ben Jarofsky show. So you are listening. To answer his question, it will make it worse. You borrow the money. That means you can't borrow it for other things that we need to pay back those loans. You have to raise taxes. Go read the history of Mayor Daley and Mayor Rahm's school board and the way they handled financing schools by going into heavy debt. Then you don't have money to pay all your other obligations that you have to go. So to answer Miles' questions, it'll make it worse. And by the way, if you thought you were going to win support from the Cranes crowd, you know, that downtown business community that loves Cranes and reads Cranes kind of the way my beloved lefties in the old days used to read, like Chairman Mao's book. Oh, my God, another story from Cranes. Capitalism is wonderful. Let me read it. You think they like you? They're already getting ready to run someone against you. You giving money to the Bears will not get them to vote for you. I hate to say it. I don't know what they were whispering in your ears, but it's not the truth. At least I will tell you the truth. All right, I answered the question. Miles asked the question. I answered it. All right, Miles, we're going to do a quick closing on my beloved Bulls. And that's kind of funny. People go, Ben, how could you love sports so much when you're always denouncing stadium handouts? I don't know. It's just What can I tell
you? Well, we should also point out, what we just saw in Kansas City a couple weeks ago was the voters in a popular referendum voted against giving more money away to the Kansas City because they got, you know, the way over financed this deal, or under financed it, and like wound up in the hole and asked for the taxpayers to bail them out, basically. And the taxpayers said no to, you know, to these billionaires, like, you know, go figure it out yourself. And so that's definitely, you know, what we've seen in other places. And we do not want to see anything like that here.
Absolutely. Patrick Mahomes was pushing that. Like, they have a really good quarterback, Mayor Johnson. Maybe we'll have a really good quarterback now, too. But
I think we do have a good quarterback.
Wow. All right. We will hold off. Moise Bawani will be coming on the show later this week. Ladies and gentlemen, they'll have a full breakdown on the football side of the Bears. The Ben Dresser Show's football expert. The guy knows football better, probably as much as anyone in the city of Chicago. All right, my beloved Bulls, your beloved Bulls, Miles. Miles is a Bulls fan, too. Went down to defeat to the hands of the dreaded Miami Heat, and their season was eliminated. So the issue is, should Bulls fans just boycott the Bulls as a way of putting pressure on them to getting better? This has been advocated by various sports writers around Chicago. They love advocating this because they get to go see the game. They get paid to go to the games. So they like blame the they're always blaming the fans while they're eating the free food at the stadium. Well, these fans are suckers. Okay, can you put a little more ketchup on this hot dog? Miles, my friends and I, we studied it, including some people you know, by the way, in my season ticket plan. We studied the evidence. We did the pros and cons, and we re-upped. Yes, Miles. we doubled down on our idiocy, and we renewed for next year. Do you agree with the sports writers of Chicago that people like myself and my friends are directly responsible for the mediocrity of the Chicago Bulls by re-upping for our season tickets? Go ahead.
Of course not. The people that are responsible for that are, you know, the Reinsdorf family, as well as, you know, Turris Karnisovas and leadership of the Bulls operation that are continuing to themselves double down on a operation that is just leading to mediocre at best results, right? I mean, there's no doubt that the deals that have been made and the deals that haven't been made by this Bulls leadership team have just mired us in the never-ending middle here, right? Where like winning one play-in game 2 years in a row is considered like, you know, the case to keep going. Like, you know, let's re-up, let's hire everybody back. You know, it's like, it's myth. They say, you know, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again. And like, yet here we find ourselves. That said, I don't think people are not going to boycott Bulls games unless they get rid of Benny. Because he is the most entertaining mascot in, you know, all of professional sports. And half the reason people go to the games is because it's a fun time at the United Center. You're seeing Benny flying all over the place. You know, you get trampolines out there. He's shooting backwards shots. He's throwing popcorn around. It's like, you know, they've gotten very good. Chicago Bulls organization is very good at making a game a fun time, even when your team is losing to the measly Detroit Pistons at halftime.
I saw that game.
Right. They'll still make you have a good time. So that's the kind of problem, right? I mean, that's what they always say, right? Is because the Bulls still have like the highest ticket sales, even though the team sucks so bad. And so how are we going to use any leverage? I don't think the fans have that much leverage, to be honest. I don't think that's really how the dynamics of this work. And I think we just need to get competent leadership. And that might require a new set of ownership and management and stuff. But clearly the issue was not just Garpax, because that was the, you know, demand of the fan base for so long was fire Garpax and Gar Foreman and John Paxson are out. I mean, Paxson's still kind of involved, I guess, but we have a new leadership who was supposed to lead us to the promised land. And look where we are with this Zach LaVine deal, this Vucevic deal. I will say Coby White and Io are reasons for hope. And I think they're going to be part of the Bulls core for going forward. And
love Io.
So just don't trade them, please. I mean, you know, whatever else you do, just don't.
All right. So one of the things about the Bulls games are the giveaways. So people go to Bulls games. They love it. I'm not talking about sports writers get in for free and get to eat hot dogs. I'm talking about real people. And they love the game. They just love, it's just like the atmosphere, as Miles is saying. And yeah, Benny the Bull is unbelievable. Great mascot. So entertaining. But one of the things they do like six times a year is they have hat giveaway night. And I could tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that like everybody in the ticket package wants to know when hat giveaway night is. It's not just like run-of-the-mill Bulls hats. It's Bulls hats designed by Chicago artists, and they're super cool. And I have collected so many over the years. I'll just show Miles. Here's one I have from a hat. I know it's awesome.
Got some flowers around the classic Chicago script logo.
Yes. And then this one, which is like a Picasso, Benny the Bull, and with this cartoon like. Yeah, very colorful. And so, like, when I go, people out in LA are like, wow, where'd you get that hat, man? That's a cool hat. They're really cool. And it's so funny to say this. Bulls fans line up on hat night. Like, there's a line out of the stadium. People get those free hats because there's limited number, Miles. I don't know if you know that. I only think they do like 8 or 10,000. I don't know. You got to get there a little early. Anyway, so the Atlanta game, which was such a wonderful, fun game to watch. The Bulls beat Atlanta to go for the right to play Miami, where they just collapsed. But the Atlanta game was a couple Wednesdays ago, I want to say. They gave away these super cool hats. And it turns out the artist who made this super cool hat is Miles. Tell the rest of the story. Go ahead.
It's the young bro. It's Walker TKL, my younger brother, who's a illustrator and designer extraordinaire, has worked with a number of different sports teams and franchises. But yeah, most recently with the Bulls, he got to give out the game ball and go up on the Jumbotron. And yeah, designed this very, very cool hat that is now, you know, can be seen on the streets of Chicago because the Bulls fans all over the place are rocking them. It's very cool. It's got this kind of swirly, abstract bull logo design. And if you look on the inlay on the inside, yeah, it has his name, Walker TKL, and his Instagram social media stuff at Walker TKL, which everybody should check out and find his stuff. He's designed for all kinds of sports teams and music artists and things like that. He does a lot of visual animations, especially of like key sports plays. He's done a lot of work with WNBA teams and the WNBA as well. And might do some, hopefully do some stuff with the Sky. You know, the Sky are coming up now. We got our new Camila Cardosa and Angel Reese, new draft picks coming in to be under Teresa Witherspoon. So it's a new era for the Chicago Sky as well. Chicago sports has some hope in the future. But yeah, everybody should definitely check out the little bro Walker TKL with his rad designs.
That is awesome, man. Little bro. And I was telling Miles and I, I learned this at the pre-show. We were chit-chatting about the Bulls, and we were both at the Atlanta game. And I go, man, the hat was so cool. And it was his brother. I went, what? And here's the thing, Miles. Like, whenever I go, I've been to a lot of art hat nights, and the artists get introduced and they get interviewed. I always feel like, well, these are the kids in high school who are good at art and didn't care about sports at all. And I'm listening to them. I get a feeling that most of them don't know the